This week on London Real, we have John Lee, CEO and co-founder of Wealth Dragons.
I want to be the first billion-dollar company around the world that teaches people self-education. You focus on adding value, and that's what brings you money. It's simple, but it's not easy. I always put myself in situations that I can't get out of. Do you want security or do you want freedom? If I was competing against myself, what would I be doing differently right now? If we don't play the game of money, the game will be played against us. If you don't commit, you're telling the universe, I'm not ready.
London Real presents John Lee, Wealth Dragons.
Anyone watching this show right now can become financially free.
And London Real, we are back in Shoreditch. It's 2015. I got a feeling it's gonna be a cracking new year. I hope you got my New Year's message when I was in Belgium, in Bruges, with my thoughts on affirmations for the year. I think it's a one little tiny thing you can be doing in the morning that can really change your game up. It's great to have goals, but if you're not repeating them back into your brain twice a day with affirmations, then I don't think they're really gonna have much point. So check my video out there. Also, the $50 billion man himself, Mr. Dan Pena, is writing for us on London Real. He posted his first blog post on January 1st. Dan likes to not mess around, as you know, and he's just talking about some of his ideas and some of his thoughts. So you can click here and check that out. It's on the blog. And we're gonna have more of those coming from the $50 billion man and other guest bloggers this year. It's gonna get pretty exciting on London Real. So today we have a gentleman by the name of John Lee, and he is the CEO and founder of Wealth Dragons. And he's got quite an interesting story. John has this kind of crazy rags to riches tale. He was literally working in his parents' Chinese takeaway restaurant in the north of England. I think they're first generation Chinese. And he went from there to being an animator designer, computer animation. And then he did his first real estate deal and made like twice of his income. And he was like, why am I in this other business? And so he switched, made his first million by 27. And now he actually teaches people how to speak. He shared the stage with people like Bill Clinton and Alan Sugar. And so now he runs Wealth Dragons, and they teach people how to make money through a bunch of different ways, real estate, online marketing, speaking, that kind of thing. So John's an interesting cat. I first learned about him when he did a video with Ty Lopez, where they were hanging out in his Lamborghini. And they both like their Lamborghinis, so you get to check that out too. So I hope you enjoy John. I won't tell you any more about him, but he had some really interesting ideas as far as getting out of your comfort zone. And that's gonna be a big theme for me this year. When I get scared of something, I'm gonna try going towards it and not run away from it. And so it's just something I hope all of us are gonna be thinking about, because the more I meet of you guys, the London Realers community, the more I realize how cool all of you fuckers are. And so I just want to really make sure that we all start pushing each other a little bit more. So there'll be more of that to come, including a couple events that'll be coming up in the first quarter of this year, some meetups here in London and more. So more information coming on that soon. And there you go. And I just want to thank our sponsors. One of them is Bulletproof, the guys that make the coffee I drink every day. And they have a bunch of other great products as well, including their Unfair Advantage. And you can pick up their new Bulletproof Diet book. I got two copies in my studio, so if you come by, you can take a look, maybe take one of them as well. So they've been big supporters. Love it. Put butter in your coffee. Why wouldn't you? It's the best way to go. So big thanks to them. And there you go. I'm going to wrap this up. It's a nice day here in Shoreditch. If you haven't got your gear for London Real, then please go do that and check it out. I got so many holiday pictures of people with coffee cups and hoodies and things like that. So thanks for that support. And make sure you also join our VIP mailing list right now. You can go to the website, type your email address in. No spam. We're just going to keep you up to date with all the cool stuff happening. And there you go. Now I leave you with Mr. John Lee of the Wealth Dragons. This is London Real. I am Brian Rose. My guest today is John Lee, who is the CEO and co-founder of Wealth Dragons, which teaches people how to increase their asset-based wealth and create passive income via real estate investment and a bunch of other ways. We're going to talk about that. You come from very humble beginnings. The story I heard is that you had Chinese parents up in the north of England that ran a takeaway business, and then you started investing early in the property market. By 27, you had made your first million. You also are a motivational speaker, and you've shared the stage with such greats as Mr. Bill Clinton, Alan Sugar, Richard Branson, and Jack Welch. I first found out about you when our former guest, Ty Lopez, posted a video of you and your Lamborghini, and we had Ty on here, and it was a great show about 2 or 3 months ago. Ty can talk. But he's a fascinating guy. You know, what I like about Ty is he doesn't really sell himself as kind of a motivational guy or a I'm going to change your life guy. He just talks, and he has some really unique wisdom about that. So we'll get to Ty later. But John, thanks so much for being here, and welcome to London Real.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, I think I had tried to contact your people and get you on, so I'm always glad when I can hook up with people I wanted to. But you've got a great story, and I know a little bit about narrative. You know, my story behind London Real is I was a greedy banker for 10 years, and I got sick of it, and I quit my job, and then I started broadcasting from this studio. And so people kind of identify with that, but I think people identify with your story because they see you. You know, you're a pretty young guy, but you're out there, you know, speaking, you're investing in property, you're teaching people, but you start from this, you know, Northern England kind of, I've seen pictures of you in, you know, in the takeaway restaurant cleaning and stuff. So before we get to Wealth Dragons, can you tell me about your background and tell us your story? Tell me what really happened.
Well, it all started off when my parents, you know, I started off as a little kid working in a Chinese takeaway. And so
it was a Chinese takeaway.
It was a Chinese takeaway, okay, yeah. Right, okay. So, you know, when you're a kid, when you come from those beginnings, you start off as a, you know, chopping mushrooms, peeling, you know, onions, and then you get upgraded and promoted to a dishwasher.
Okay. And how old were you when you started?
Oh, God, I must have been 7 years old.
Okay. And were your parents first generation or second generation?
First generation.
First generation. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I mean, going through that whole life and seeing my parents, I never really saw my parents at the actually age of 11 years old, because they would, you know, start work at 5, they wouldn't come back, and they would finish work at like 12 o'clock. And it was actually my aunties and uncles that brought me up.
Wow. You know, sounds like Americans with that work ethic.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, working 3 jobs. I would work in a job in telesales, then I would work in the weekends, I would go and work in and sell shoes. And then in the evening of the weekend, I would go to my mom's Chinese takeaway and I would work. And it wasn't, it was one day I remember just seeing my parents work really, really hard and just like looking at them. And you know, when sometimes you look at your parents and each day they get older and older and older.
Yeah.
They start to get the gray hair and they start to get those little dots that happen in the face. And as I saw that, I thought, my God, my parents are getting older. I'm not really spending much time with them. And it's funny because all my aunties and uncles all around me were doing the same thing. They were having children. They weren't spending time with them. They'd be working in a job. And when I looked at it, I thought, you know, there's got to be a better, faster way of making money. You know, and my parents said, yeah, there is. You need to go to school and you need to get a job. And so,
which is the classic immigrant mindset. My kids are going to be better educated than me, and then they're going to make it. Right. Okay.
Right. And so, you know, for me, I thought, okay, well, let's try education. So then I worked really hard, and I'm dyslexic, so I found it really, really hard going through college, university, because I literally can't write. Even now, when I'm looking at words, I can't read them.
Wow.
You know, and it's very difficult for me. And so going through this education and watch my parents slave away at the walks and just seeing them literally work just so I could have an education. And then it's funny because when I graduated, you know, I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to get a job now because our parents have paid so much money. And when you graduate from university, you walk out with debt, right?
Yeah.
And so I thought, I'm going to get a job. And what happens? You don't get a job. You know, you pay this money to go to university and you're supposed to guarantee to get a job, but it doesn't happen. So what do? You go out and look, and you look for more jobs, and you look for more jobs. And eventually I did get a job. I started from £21,000. And within 2 years, I got up to £36,000 when I was working in central London.
Right.
And you know, it's like working in London. It's like, they're like people like robots, you know, they're walking around kind of like this, and they're not really paying attention. They're just, people are just doing their own thing. And I would wake up every day at 6 o'clock. I would, you know, my commute to it would be 3 hours. And I would work every single day till about 7, 8 o'clock at night. I wouldn't get home till 10:30 at night. And by that time, my partner at the time would either be in bed and my dinner would be in the oven. And I thought, this is like not a way to live.
And this is like early 20s for you.
Early 20s.
Okay.
And, you know, and the funny thing is, this is what I'd worked for. You know, I'd worked all this in university and to make my parents proud and really to say, hey, you know, all the stuff that you're doing, you're slaving away. Well, you know what? I'm going to make you proud. And I walked out with a first. But nowadays, a degree doesn't really mean anything. You know, it's kind of like, well, you got a first, so what? Most graduates that graduate now, they're not even working the jobs they want to work in. I remember I was in Malaysia. He sent his daughter over to film school over here. He spent 4 million ringgits bringing his daughter over here. Now she works in a coffee shop. You know, and it's like, if you're going to teach these things at school, and I always look at this, why do people go to school? Because they want to get a job. Why do we get a job? So we can earn money, so we can live, right? Why do we live? So we can have a life. But really, think about it. People, they're not really living. They're just really existing. They're like doing everything. They're not human beings. They're human doings. They're doing stuff every single day.
What's the line from Fight Club? Working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need.
Right.
That's what Brad Pitt says, right?
Right.
But yeah, and when you're in London, you see it in central London. You do see this kind of a drone mass that are kind of, your life is being lived for you. You don't know why you're doing it. You think you're doing it to make your parents proud. But like you said, the whole point of life is to live it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, the funny thing is, and I'll never forget this, when I went from that 21,000 to 36,000, when I started the job at the end of that month when I got my paycheck, because I was doing all the calculations, right? And when I got my paycheck, I looked at it and I thought, this is not right. So I called HR department and I said, can I just make sure that I'm on a £36,000 salary, right? He said, yeah. I said, why is it that I only have this? And he said, well, you got to pay this much and this much and this much. And you know, the funny thing is, I worked out through the entire year that I would be paying about £10,000 worth of tax, plus national insurance and all those bits and bobs. My pay every single month was only £2,000 a month, right? Minus, again, all the taxes. My outgoings was £1,200. That left me with £800 a month. Divided by 4 weeks, that's £200 a week. Divided by 7 days, that's £27 a day.
Jesus.
A £36,000 salary.
I can hear all the people quitting right now in the world. All right. So, but you know, for you to make these realizations yourself is tricky. I mean, you know, without attending courses or reading books, I mean, did you just have this epiphany where you're like, I don't want to live the rest of my life like this? Or how did you change things?
It's funny. One of my best friends' name is Darren. And, you know, we go to university together and he works in London now still. And he's very successful at what he does. And
it's not Darren Brown, the magician. Is
no,
it?
No, no, okay. No.
Just checking. All right.
And so, you know, we always had this thing of like this, if do whatever it takes to get the result. Like university, we'd turn up at 6 o'clock in the morning before the caretaker, they would let us in and we wouldn't go partying, we'd really study. And so we did the same in our careers. And it's funny because at one point I got a job in the same company as he did. And it was my birthday and he gave me this book, and this book was called Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Oh no, okay.
And I read this book. This book said, oh my God, you're trading time for money. What happens if you get hit by a bus tomorrow? Your income's going to start. Oh my God, you're right. And I remember not being able to go on holiday because, you know, if I wanted to take leave, especially my background is working in TV and film and animation and films.
Right.
And so it's a pretty tight deadline. So you couldn't just take 2 weeks off whenever you wanted. You know, you would have to finish the project, make sure the project's finished, then you can take leave. And so I remember asking for time off, and my manager at the time said, there's no way. There's no way. I said, I just need a week. There's no way. This project's this. And I remember reading in the book that most of us, we're trading time for money. We work so hard for money, but what we need to do is we need to make money work really hard for us.
You're quoting Kiyosaki there.
Right.
Right. Okay. Right. So are you the Chinese English version of Robert Kiyosaki?
I don't know. I've been called many things.
But yeah, it wouldn't be bad if they called you that.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Okay, so I sat down with Robert 2 months ago. He was giving a talk at the Excel Center. And in between his, you know, two-day talk with his wife, Kim, there and all this stuff, I grabbed 30 minutes with him backstage, right?
Yeah.
And I sat down with him. Now, I was familiar with the book, but quite honestly, I had never read it cover to cover.
Yeah.
But I had researched him and I talked to Robert, and he's a fascinating guy. I mean, you know, he's the real deal. I mean, he was on
on Oprah in like the 90s. Yeah. I mean, like, come on, he's been around. Yeah. And then I listened to his audiobook afterwards, and I listened to Rich Dad, and I did it like all in one go afterwards. And it's a powerful book,
yeah.
You know, and it's something very special and unique, right? It's a different way of looking at things.
Oh, absolutely.
And at the time, it really hit as a different thing. And it's all about making money work for you. And it's really about not being brainwashed with this system that we've been taught to kind of grow up and aspire to. And then we find out we're not happy, and then we don't know why. And then we drink too much or whatever. And then we die, right?
Right. It's just kind of what happened. I mean, when I read the book, I thought, wow, this is fascinating because, you know, there are other options out there. And if you think about it, we go to school and, you know, I go to my parents. I say, hey, mom, can I have some money? She said, yeah, go and speak to your dad. So I go to dad, say, dad, can I get some money? And your dad would say, yeah, go out and get a job. He doesn't say go out and trade Forex or invest in property or start your own business or invest in this for something different. You know, they'd say go out and get a job because that's how everyone's been conditioned. I remember one time I was working at Mom's Chinese Takeaway. And an onion, when you have an onion, there's different ways you can cut the onion.
Yeah.
So the way my mum used to cut it was to carve it out and then cut it and then cut it, you know, in two halves. I said, Mum, why do you do that? And I said, why don't you just cut it down the middle, carve it out that way? It's faster, it's quicker, it's safer, right? Less effort. I said, oh, well, you know, it's the way that your grand's always told me to do this. And just because something has been done so long, it doesn't mean it's the right way. And also, we've always got to start thinking out of the box. So how did I come with that, you know, that epiphany? Well, it wasn't an epiphany. It actually came down to pain. I hated traveling to London. I hate commuting.
So you were commuting from Manchester at the time or what?
No, from Guildford.
Okay, Guildford.
Guildford.
Okay,
so Guildford. It's still a long travel, yeah. You know, from door to door when you're parking up. And for me, it was the pain. You know, there's one time I remember, I'll never forget this, Leicester Square. I walked downstairs into the tube station. The whole tube station was empty. I blink and then... In split second, there's all these people appear from nowhere speaking different languages. I thought, okay, so let's walk to the other end so I can get a seat. So the tube comes, the doors open, and it's full. And I kind of like squash myself in like a sardine.
Yeah, it's a humbling experience taking the tube at rush hour here.
And this is in summer, right? You know what it's like in summer, sweating.
There's no AC on a lot of these.
Right. Yeah. And so the thing that really topped it off the most was this guy turned around, he put his hand on the rail. My head was in his armpit. I could look up, the smell was like this horrible BO. Right. And just for me, it's like, why do I go through this? And there was one time when I went to work where my supervisor sat down with me and told me that I wasn't going to do my job. And therefore, if you don't buck up your ideas, you're not going to be working here anymore.
And okay, so you hit rock bottom and you had read Kiyosaki's book.
Yeah.
And so you dove into the real estate market. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
And what happened? Was it your first go? Did it take some time? I mean, you know, we hear these stories about real estate riches. Was it that easy? Did it take some creativity? Talk to
me. It's kind of like this. It's simple, but it's not easy. It's like losing weight, right? It's simple to lose weight, eat less, exercise more, but no one does it. And it's like with real estate, it's simple. It's simple. There's only three strategies. Number one, find the deal, right? So is that easy to do? Yeah, because they're everywhere. But most people don't know that deals exist. Deals are everywhere. If we could go out now, within an hour, we'd find a deal just by knowing to look for the right things, just by telltale signs. And so one of the first deals I bought for $164,000 and I sold it for $222,000. And I was like—
You still remember the numbers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I still remember that. And then the one after that was, again, one of my first deals. I bought for $85,000 and I sold it for $185,000. I was like, my God, I just made like 3 years worth of my salary in a space of 3 or 4 months. You know, it was crazy. And it's like that paradigm shift, because sometimes you hear about this stuff and you think it sounds too good to be true. And we've been conditioned to think, well, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. But that is not true. There's people out there that are doing things creatively that we don't think about.
But I'm guessing you had to really conquer some fears there, because when you're going to pull the trigger on that mortgage, that's when a lot of people walk away, right?
I remember sitting there with my partner next to me, and she said, if you sign that, we're going to be committed. And I was this close to not doing that deal, you know. And same with my friends around me. I'll tell my friends, I got this great deal. And there's one in Camberley. I said, look, this property is worth $165,000. It's just been offered to me at $124,000. So I tell my friend, the first thing my friend says to me is, what's wrong with it?
Right.
Whereas if I was to tell an investor, go, boom, that's a good deal, snap it up. You don't even have to think about those deals. You know, when those deals come along, it's like, you got to think about it. You're in the wrong business. You know, but this thing about hanging around people who are not doing the things you want to do. You talk about fear. My God, I was surrounded by fear. It's like every time I'll take 3 steps forward, I'd be going back 10 steps, you know, and I'd be second guessing myself. And that little voice comes into play, doesn't it?
Because of your peer group, you mean?
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And so, but once you get over that fear, do you understand that okay, when you did your second deal and your third deal, when you get to sign, you're like, okay, I know this is going to be scary. I know this is going to be scary, but I know I'm going to push through it. I mean, is that what makes you different than people that don't do these deals?
You know, it's all about habit. You know, it's you know, some people say to me, oh, John, you shouldn't be doing that. I said, why? Because it's risky. I said, well, it's risky to you because you don't do it every day. But it's not risky to me because I do it every day. And I remember watching this documentary on Muhammad Ali, and he was really old, and he's going to get into fighting. And someone said, Muhammad Ali, you know, shouldn't you like retire now? Because like you're at the top of your game. And if you have another fight, isn't that risky? Like you could get knocked out. And he said, you know, it doesn't matter because when I get into the ring, I've been fighting for a long time. So I know that I got a pretty high chance of winning. It's not risky to me because I do it every day. And so the difference between, I guess, myself and other people out there is I've just been doing this stuff often, very often. I mean, not even that long, like 10 years I've been in business, right? But what I do is I do things every single day. So someone says to me, John, I've been playing the guitar for a year, right? How many times do you play a day? Well, I play once a week. Well, I play the guitar every single day for half an hour. So who has more experience? So it's stuff that you got to do every single day. Like when you do it every single day, it becomes a part of you. It becomes routine, like we were talking about before.
And that means you're pushing yourself to taking those risks and putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. You're not just looking at the property listings. You're going out and pushing yourself to be a better entrepreneur and a better...
Yeah, I mean, the way I don't just do property now. I invest in a lot of different types of businesses. Okay. And when I invest now, I go, right, well, I'm this age now. I'm pretty young. So if I invest in this, if I don't invest in this now, I don't want to be 70 years old and go, oh my God, I should have took that deal. I should have invested in that. Because what I say is that if you don't take risks now, you'll be forced to take risks when you're older.
Yeah. Amen to that. Amen. And I say that when I meet people that are very low risk profiles. I say, look, you're taking a risk right now by not doing anything.
Right.
Like, and Jeff Bezos calls it the regret minimization trade. So Amazon is his lifetime regret minimization, because he doesn't want to wake up at 7 years old and say, you didn't do a damn thing with your life. You just worked for IBM and you never took any risks. So that's what he's doing, you know, with his life, you know, by doing that. So tell me about Wealth Dragons, because you could have just stayed where you were. You could have probably just continued, doing real estate and doing more of these deals and become more wealthy. Yeah. So why get out there and get on stage? Why get in front of people? Why teach people how to do this? Well, where'd that come from?
You know, when you make your first million, people think, oh, wow, you know, that's, you must retire now and do things. And that's
what
people
expect. These days, a million doesn't mean much.
And it doesn't mean much. But at the time when I did retire. I mean, I was financially free. I didn't have to work.
Right.
But the funny thing is, you would call your friends up on a Wednesday, right? You say, hey, let's go out tonight. Oh, I can't. I'm working. Okay, well, next weekend, let's fly to Paris for the weekend. Oh, I can't. I don't have any holidays left. And the funny thing is that when you're free, everybody else isn't free. So you got to find something to do with your life. And, you know, the thing is this, and one thing I figured out in business, if you focus on money, you don't get money. One thing I realized is you focus on adding value, and that's what brings you money, right? And you don't do it because you want to do it for the money. You do it because of the value. You know, when I made that first million, I thought, okay, well, shall I just quit or shall I carry on doing other things? And it was from talking to other people and people saying, oh, you know, complaining about their lives. And I thought, you know, you don't have to complain. Do you know you can do this, 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 and this to be able to get out of your job? If you hate your job so much, why are you still doing it? And so I got so frustrated with people, and they would come to me for advice and say, oh, John, I want to do what you're doing. And I would sit down with them, I would spend my time with them, and I would teach them. And then a year later, I say, have you done that yet? And they say, no, I haven't done it. So I always used to think about, why is it that there's a group of people that say they're going to do something but don't do it, and there's a group of people that say they're going to do it and they do it? And I found the difference is their why, their reason. Is right. Their motivation.
Right, because now in your Wealth Dragons class, you don't teach people the how, you also talk about the whys, right?
The why is like 80% of it.
That's it. I'm guessing people think they're coming to a Wealth Dragons seminar to learn about real estate, but I'm guessing you end up teaching them about themselves.
That's one of the big things. Okay. You see, it's not just about real estate. It depends on what your wealth profile is. Some people don't like to manage property. Some people don't like to mingle with people. Some people want to sit in their homes and make money. Well, there's a strategy. You can use Forex for that, for example. Right. You know, Forex is a great strategy. You know, and so one of the reasons why I do this is we were never taught this stuff at school. We were never taught to trade Forex. We were never taught to invest in real estate. We were never taught to invest in businesses. We were taught to get in the job, work for someone else, and make them wealthy. even Harvard MBAs, you know, they get taught to go in there and make other people rich. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But when people come to me and they complain about their lives and they say, and I tell them to do something about it and they don't do it, I just think, why is that? So the reason why we started Wealth Dragons is people kept asking me these questions over and over and over again. And I thought, you know what? Instead of spending one-on-one time with you, let's leverage my time, right? Because what happened is, even at that point when I made my first meal, I thought, let's invest in other businesses as well. So I started that, and I started, you know, writing journals and writing books. And then people would say, hey, can I ask you this question? I say, you know what, I'll just send you an email, right? And it's got everything in there, because the questions would always be the same. Right. How do I raise finance? How do I find deals? What businesses should I invest in? How do I make passive income? You know, how do I find a mentor? It's the same questions.
Okay. And then you made videos next. No.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I did. Okay. So I made videos and then, you know, I started getting the message out there. So why did we start Wealth Dragons? My message is very simple. Anyone watching this show right now can become financially free. Anyone. And anyone can become rich if they want to. They are two different things. There's financial freedom to buy back your time, and the time you can use to make you rich. And that's what I did.
Okay, you know, so those are two different things.
Two different things.
First, you want to get your time, and then if you want, you can trade your time for riches.
Correct.
Okay.
Right? But the thing is, I always realize that, you know, people say, oh yeah, money doesn't buy happiness. Well, technically it doesn't, but I tell you, money's not everything in the world, but it ranks pretty high there with oxygen, right? You know, we live in a world of money, so we have to play the game of money. If we don't play the game of money, the game will be played against us. I see a lot of people working so hard, friends of mine working in organizations, paying money to pensions. And we all know about pensions, you know, they're relying on it. But when they retire, it's going to be a different story. You know, we need to teach people how to manage their finances, how to manage their financial education, how to create wealth, how to take care of the next generation. Like my kids, when, you know, I don't have kids yet, but when I do have kids, I've already bought investments for them.
Right. So with Wealth Dragons, how do you, you've seen this where you've given people advice and they don't do anything. Mm. I've had that experience as well. So when you go to teach your first class, or when you're lately, you know, doing your Wealth Dragons courses, how can you shake them out of that? You know, what can you do in those day or two that you have with them in a seminar standing that'll actually get them to make the changes? Because, you know, so often people just don't.
Yeah.
But a lot of people want to come for entertainment reasons.
Yeah.
A lot of people want to come because they want to tell themselves that they tried something, right?
Yeah, correct.
But getting people to make real change is hard.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
One of the things that we do is we do something called results in advance. So when people come to me, like if I pick up this phone and show you how much money I'm making now, even while we're having this conversation, people would think it sounds too good to be true. They think it's like a scam. Right? Because they don't know this stuff. Like, you can take your mobile phone and you can be making money right now. Watching this show, by the time this show finishes, you could be making money. And it sounds too good to be true. No, I'm just saying.
Okay.
You know, but there's so many different vehicles out there that people can do. So one of the things that we do is we give people results in advance. So, for example, some people come to our program. We had this lady come to our program. Her name was Rochelle. By Sunday at 6 p.m. or 6:30, she left the event. By 10 o'clock that night, she'd already made £600. By 8 a.m. in the morning, she'd already made £1,200. And it's like, people go, how is that even possible? She even posted on Facebook. You know, she was showing her accounts, this is how much I made.
Did she rob a bank? Or what's she doing?
Well, we taught her a strategy for creating passive income, but she never thought about this before. You know, because what happens is, if you and I walked to someone on the street now with a £50 note and said, give me £1 for this £50 note, they'll be doing this. They would go, well.
And is that because people are risk averse, or, because let's go deeper on this, because the psychology fascinates me. Is it because they're risk averse, or is it because they fear failing, or do they fear success? There's a lot of weird things going on here when people tell you, oh, it's a risky deal. Yeah. I'm not sure, John, about that. I mean, what are they sub-communicating to you?
What they're really saying is, I don't want to fail. Right? I don't want to try this, so therefore I'm going to say this stuff to protect me, because that's what your brain does.
Right.
It finds shortcuts. If the problem with your brain is, it's kind of like, if you think of it as a different entity, it's like your worst enemy.
Right.
Because it knows your deeper secrets, it knows your weaknesses, it knows how to manipulate you and talk you out of stuff.
Right, so it's constantly trying to trick you.
It's constantly trying to trick you.
And you can't trust what it says.
You can't, and that's why, you know, sometimes you hear people talk about a gut feeling. Like, when I get into a business deal, you know, normally it's a gut feeling. Like, I know this is going to be a great deal.
Yeah.
I know it's going to be good.
Yeah.
And there's two voices that speak. You got your voice here and you got a voice here. Right. So you just got to follow that gut feeling.
Follow the gut, right? Because when you look back on the gut feelings from throughout your life, it's probably got like up near a 70, 80% hit ratio, maybe higher, right?
Well, it's like this sixth sense. I mean, I can't explain it. I'm into, you know, how powerful the brain. I recently watched a film called Lucy, right? You know, how the brain can get to 100% and it can do all sorts of things. You know, but I think that most people right now they're not even trying. They're not even like when I decided to quit my job and become an entrepreneur. The question I ask myself is, am I good enough? If 1 year in 1 year I don't do anything, in 1 year am I good enough to get my job back? And the answer was yes.
Okay.
So even, but people aren't even given a try because they don't have the support group. They don't know how. They don't know where to start. They don't have a mentor. They don't have someone hold them accountable.
Right.
I mean, you're in great shape. So, I mean, you have.
Thank you.
You know, you've got this, you know, accountability on yourself that I've got to train every day. I've got to eat right every day. And, you know, we had a drink later and you tell me all this fascinating stuff about us. That's a commitment, right? But most people don't have that. And they've got to learn to build that up because they're in a habit of doing things that are not getting them the results.
Okay, talk to me about peer group. Should you get rid of your friends? I mean, I had someone recently that says, go through your mobile phone and delete all of these numbers of the people you don't want in your life and then don't call them back. I mean, do you think you should take an active, I mean, look, I had Tim Ferriss in that seat 2 years ago and I said, Tim, would you have New Year's resolutions? And he said, you know what, Brian, I'm thinking about the things I want to eliminate from my life. Mm. I never heard that before.
Yeah.
And so he was thinking about things he wanted to stop doing, people he wanted to stop hanging out with. Mm. Do you go that hardcore?
I probably wouldn't go that. Well, I made a decision when I left home to go to university. I had two choices. I could have gone to university in Manchester, or I could have gone miles and miles away. And I chose one miles and miles away because it means that I wouldn't be seeing my peer group as much. There's a saying that says that people can stay in your hearts, but not in your lives. And really, it's a very simple question, Brian. The people you hang around, are they benefiting you? Are they empowering you or disempowering you? And I call these red lighters and green lighters. Red lighters, every time you come up with an idea and you tell your friend, they go, that's never going to work. Oh, yeah, okay, no, it's impossible. These are red lighters that stop you from doing things. Green lighters are people that say, you know, that sounds a good idea. You should give it a shot. You should give it a go. Why don't you try that? These people encourage you. So I would say to people, write down a list of all the people you hang around.
You know what the best way I found? Go through your phone and look at the last 10 text messages or 15. Because
yeah.
Those are the people you're constantly communicating.
Right.
And then, as John says, put a red light next to them or a green light. Right?
Yeah.
And then make a digital decision. Is that what you're saying?
Well, make a decision. You know, life's all about choices. But the problem is, it's really hard to break out of that because that has become, in effect, a habit. Because when you hang around people, sometimes when you're sick, you know, you moan. And the reason why people moan is because they want attention. And their belief, their connection is, okay, if I don't get attention when I'm not sick, so let's just be sick all the time, and then I can get lots of attention.
Again, your brain making a trick on you.
Correct.
Have you heard of this 10-day challenge where you don't complain for 10 days? It was another Ferrisism. Yeah, try it out. I was trying it like a week ago. I mean, I don't complain that much anyways, but you know, challenge your friends to do it. It's 10 days, and you don't complain about anything.
Yeah.
And just find how it changes your whole day. So you can't no longer complain about the weather, the tube, the nothing. So when you see someone, you can't complain.
Yeah.
You have to talk about something else.
Yeah.
And just watch how it flips your frame of mind.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's just a thought. Talk to me about mentors. Everyone asked me, Brian, how do I find mentors? I had Ryan Holiday in that seat, who was the mentor of Robert Greene, you know, the guy who wrote 48 Laws of Power and the 50th Law with 50 Cent. And, you know, he was like, Brian, I never asked Robert to be my mentor. I just volunteered for him and I did all this work for him and then I got all this knowledge. So how did you find your mentor? How do you tell people to find mentors?
You know,
it's tricky.
You know, this is a very interesting point. One of my first mentors, his name was Ying Tan. And he was a mortgage broker. And I remember calling him and I said, I got this property deal. And he looked and he said, that's not a property deal. I said, what do you mean? He said, this is a property deal. And he told me the difference between a good deal and a bad deal. And I said, wow, you really know your stuff. I said, how many properties do you own? And he told me, I thought, wow, and you're pretty young. I said, hey, do you think you can sit down with me and, you know, I'll buy you coffee and you know, you can teach me this stuff. And his response to that is no. And I was like, okay. Why are you being so rude?
Because right? He's busy, maybe.
Right. Okay. Well, these guys are. And one thing about mentors is they're busy.
Yeah.
They have businesses. You know, they're doing their own thing.
Right. And I said, successful guys like to see young, hungry guys.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And so here's the thing. I said to him, okay, well, when are you free? I'm never free. I said, all right, what's it going to take for me to sit down with you for a few hours just to pick your brain? And he said, if you want to spend a day with me, right, or two, or a weekend with me, 2 days, it's £10,000. And I looked him in the eye and I said, sorry? And he said, £10,000. And I said, I don't have £10,000. He says, that's exactly the reason why you need me as your mentor. I said, why? He says, because you can't even find £10,000 for your business. How are you going to find the rest of this for your life? I said, good point. So I went home and I told my partner at the time, and I said to him, look, this guy wants 10 grand to coach me. And she said, that's crazy. It's crazy. And so I went back to our corner and said, look, can you not just sit down with me just for an hour? He said, it's going to take 2 days. You want to learn this, if you're serious, put some skin in the game. I said, what do you mean skin in the game? He said, look, I can teach you for free, but I know you're not doing anything. I know that you're going to take this stuff, you're going to go back to your life, and there's no hurt money. I want you to put the money where your mouth is. Find me 10 grand in the next week, and I'll coach you. And I thought, there's no way. I mean, like, 10 grand. So, and here's
this
the thing.
This is 10 grand sterling for all you Yanks.
Pounds,
listening.
Yeah.
Right, pounds, right.
Right? And I remember sitting there thinking, how am I going to do this? And here's the interesting thing. The better question you ask yourself, the quality of the question determines the quality of the answer. So, right, where can I get 10 grand from? And so I went to all these places, you know, and I just thought, there's no way. And I remember looking out of my window on the drive, and I saw my car. Honda S2000 convertible, six speed, 256 brake horsepower. And I worked so hard. Yeah, right. I worked so hard to get that car. So I thought, okay, well, if I pay him, because I spent all the time justifying, I pay him 10 grand, I get the knowledge, I shortcut it, and then I can make more than that. And so I didn't tell my partner at the time. So I sold my car for £15,000. I paid him 10,000. I was left with 5,000 left, which then I spent buying another car, which wasn't such a great car. And those 2 days with him, after 2 days, 6 months later, I bought 35 houses. because listen to this, he knew a way of buying houses without having to use money. And I was like, boom. If you don't need money to buy houses, how many houses can you buy? You know, and that's how myself, my business partner, has transacted hundreds of property deals just by using the same methodology. I still use the same methodology today in Holland, in Malaysia, in the UK, all around the world.
So he took your money, this mentor.
He took my money. I paid him 10 grand.
Okay, and he took it. He was like, thank you very much.
Boom.
And then he gave you a full 2 days. He probably mentored you for even longer than that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had some support after that as well.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Emails here and there. And I thought, wow.
And how old were you when you made that call, that 10 grand call?
24 years old.
Jesus, man. Well, you went all in.
Yeah.
I mean, risk comes reward. And it's fascinating. You mentioned this 10 grand price point. I just spent a week up in Scotland with an interesting man who has a castle. And you go up there for a week. His name is Dan Pena. Mm-hmm. He's known as the $50 billion man. And his price point is 10 grand as well. Mm-hmm. And I got back and there was like 16 people there. A lot of people had heard about him on London Real. And a few of my friends I've talked to since I got back, I'm like, you know, you should go up there for a week. You know, Dan Pena, sort your head out. And they're like, I can't afford 10 grand. And I'm like, dude, you make six figures. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They're like, oh, they give me all the reasons they can't. Yeah. I'm like, you're going to get 100 to 1,000 times return on that in a few years. But they're like, no, I'm not going to do it.
You know, because people can't see the value.
But, I mean, or is that a way of them not doing something? Is that an excuse to not doing something? Is it a reason not to fail or a reason not to succeed?
I just think sometimes when you're running six figures, people are comfortable. You know, they get comfortable. They're not pushing themselves. Like, one of my idols is Bruce Lee, right? No relation, by the way.
That's funny, man.
In fact, my nickname at school was Brucey.
Okay. Why was Bruce Lee your idol? He's many people's idol, but why was he
because
yours?
Because he's always striving to be the best. Like, look at Tiger Woods, you know, he doesn't want to be the best golfer in the world. He wants to be the best golfer that ever lived. Mm. You know, and that's a different mindset. You know, like for us, if I'm every single day not pushing myself every single day, some people think I'm crazy. Sometimes I sleep when I'm only exhausted. It's not something I condone, but it's something I enjoy doing, I'm passionate about it. It's not motivation. Motivation wanes. Passion, you want to wake up after 3 hours sleep because you want to get on the next thing. I don't know about you, Brian, but I always think there's a sense of urgency in life. You know, at the age of 27, actually, when I made my first million, I thought I was invincible, driving Lamborghinis, you know, like, you can't touch me, I'm bulletproof. I almost died in a car accident in the same freaking car, right? And at that point, that was a wake-up call for me. I thought, wow, I've got all this knowledge in my head. I've got all these people around the world that I can touch and change. If I left the earth at that point, what value have I left to earth, to people? What legacy have I left? Like now I know that I've trained thousands of people around the world. I have books, I have videos with millions of views on there. You know, I run events, I've got CD programs. Now, if something was like to happen, a part of me still lives on that can educate the next generation. And if we can educate the next generation, this is where my business partner's daughter inspired me. His daughter's 9 years old. She's got a business. It's called Hart's Eggs. She buys eggs for £1 and sells them for £1.50. She gets 40 quid a week. She's like 9 years old. Imagine if all our kids did that. Imagine if all our kids understood financial education. We would change the next generation. The next generation would evolve a lot differently than where we are now. In the Chinese culture, they say three generation rich. First generation makes the money. Second generation keeps it. Third generation spends all the money and it starts again. Right. We don't want to do that.
Right.
We want to make the money and have that legacy last. My kids, when they're born, when I pass everything down to them, they're not allowed to sell my property empire. They have to keep it and just live off the cash flow.
So it's like in a trust or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. You know.
Tell me about the Chinese background. Your company's called Wealth Dragons,
yeah.
Which kind of has some Asian kind of themes to it.
Yeah.
Your parents are first generation Chinese. You know, what is it like growing up in a Chinese family? We've seen these books in the U.S. called Tiger Mom.
Yeah.
You know, being children of immigrant parents. I mean, I'm an immigrant in this country. Most Americans are immigrants. So you come with this mentality of yeah. I'm going to work so hard and I'm going to put my kids through something better. And what's it like coming from a Chinese background? What are the positives? What are the negatives?
It's very strict. Very strict.
Okay.
You know, if you didn't do things right.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people watching who are Asian understand what I'm talking
right,
about here.
Right. But is yeah. that good? Because you look at kids in England sometimes, maybe in the North, and like these kids haven't been disciplined their whole lives.
Yeah.
And you're like, Jesus Christ.
You know, this is a fine line. I mean, a lot of Chinese people are not disciplined. You know, I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. What I'm saying is that, you know, we got to find ways to discipline our kids. In some respect.
Because you can discipline the creativity right out of them.
Right, right. I mean, like, my parents used to make me sit down, and in Chinese school, I would have to memorize a whole book. I didn't even know what I was learning, but I'd have to memorize the whole book.
Okay.
And, you know, that gave me a lot of discipline to the lessons I learned today. You know, and treating people like you want to be treated. Or always trying to help people. Or always trying to be, again, is competition good? I personally think it is because it keeps you on top of your game. My mindset is if I'm sitting and doing nothing, I think to myself, if I was competing against myself, what would I be doing differently right now?
Right.
Right? And so right. It kind of gave me that competitive mindset that when all the Chinese parents sit around the Chinese restaurant having a meal, they say, oh, well, my son is this and my daughter is this. Ha, ha, ha. Right?
Is that what it's like?
That's what it's like.
Okay, cool.
That's what it's like. Oh, my son's a doctor. My son's a accountant. My daughter is a dentist. You know, then that's when I grew up, my parents wanted me to be an accountant.
Right.
Which I'm terrible at maths. That's why I have a CFO, you know? So coming from a Chinese background, I think I'm blessed to come from a background like that because even my parents were really hard on me. It taught me lessons in life that I now use in business, the way I discipline myself, where I go and be the very best I can be, where, you know, like you shouldn't waste time, you know, where you should always invest for the future. You know, and I think in our society, people are very short term. They want like instant gratification. And sometimes you got to think long term. You got to know, hey, that's what I want. And here's what I got to do to get there. I was never bright at school. I mean, I was like the kid who sat in the class with a special needs teacher. You know, I was the kid that everyone would laugh at. You know, I would get all the questions wrong. You know, I remember one time there was two Qs. You had the A students on one side and you had the D students on the other. And I remember all the A students pointing and saying, oh, you're thick, you're stupid. You're retarded.
You're dyslexic as well, so that doesn't help.
Right, right.
Talk to me about motivational speaking. I'm giving a TED Talk next week. I got like 4.5 weeks left. I've been practicing. But it's something that everyone wants to be better yeah. at speaking. And yeah. most people are bad at it,
yeah.
including CEOs and founders and stuff, because it yeah. takes practice.
Yeah.
But you teach people how to do it,
absolutely.
As well as doing it yourself.
Yeah.
So what have you learned about your own journey? Like, what were your first steps of getting better yourself? And how do you teach people how to do it? Are there just basic things? Are there simple things?
Well, there's a template. Like when you go on stage, the audience is skeptical, but also when you go on stage for the first time, you're nervous. That's a bad combination.
Right.
Right. So whenever you're speaking to the audience, people go, oh, I'm really nervous. Oh, well, what if I say this wrong? It's not about you. It's about the audience. The audience, they don't, most speakers walk on stage and go, me, 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 me. They don't care about that. They care about what's in it for them. Right? So one thing you got to do when you walk on stage in front of an audience, you've got to grab everyone's attention within the 10 seconds.
Right.
Right? If you don't have them at the start, you don't have them at the end. Right? So when you're speaking on stage, you got to simplify things. Like, I take very complex matters and simplify them. And I always think of the communication as this. A six-year-old should be able to understand what you're saying. So if you want to practice in front of a six-year-old, and then at the end, ask them if they understood it.
Literally get a
literally, six-year-old. Literally sit okay. there and draw the diagrams and say, does this make sense? Right? And another thing as well is, like, most speakers, they use PowerPoint. But the thing is, the audience is not, if they're using PowerPoint, they're looking at the PowerPoint presentation. They're not looking at you.
Right.
And when you are there, they're looking at you. That's when you have your power to influence. Because when you're talking, you're really selling yourself. You're selling your idea. You're selling your concept. You know, you're selling the audience why they need to listen to you and why your message is so important. Everyone has a message. Everyone has a story. One thing I learned, you know, speaking in front of thousands of people, is you've got to be able to take that message and relate it to the audience. Like, when I stand on stage, I don't tell people how rich I am. I tell people how miserably I failed in business and what it cost me. Because they don't want to hear about the success stories. They want to hear about the stuff that was really challenging to me.
Right.
The things that, you know, where you almost went bust, where the moment you almost gave up, because the audience wants to know that you are like them. And the moment they know that you are like them, and that's why I come to this concept called story selling. Right, not storytelling, story selling.
Okay.
You don't teach the how. When you teach how, people are sitting there with itchy hands. When you teach them how to do it, it's kind of like you're taking the itch away. So you got to sell the why, not the how. When you sell the why, remember, the why is the 80% reason why people are going to do something. When you're on stage, you want to inspire people to action, to do something. They don't want to just stand up and give you a standing round of applause. You don't want that. You want them at the end of this presentation, they're going to go out and their life will fundamentally change.
Right.
So how do you do that? You've got to tell a story in a certain way. And there's four parts: beginning, middle, climax, and end.
Okay.
Right? And you have the turnaround.
I'm going to take some notes here. Yeah, all right, go ahead.
And also you have...
the turnaround.
Yeah, so the turnaround. Okay. So it's the story of the turnaround. In fact, when you create your presentations, there's actually 7 points. First point is the introduction. So one thing I do is I always ask a question. So most people, they sat there like this, right? Really skeptical. So I asked a question. I said, raise your hand if you'd like to learn how to make a lot more money. You can't say no to that, right? So people have to uncross their arms to raise their hand. So that gets rid of resistance, right? And then you want to ask a second question, you know, because this engages the audience. So the first thing you got to do is engage the audience. Most people make the mistake and say, my name is John Lee and I'm this and I'm the CEO and blah. They don't care. They care about what's in it for them. In the talk today, I'm going to show you 4 different ways on how you can earn a passive income. Boom, done. Are you interested? Yes, of course you're interested. So
that's the introduction. And then there's 6 more steps.
Introduction.
Right.
Also, in the introduction, you have to thank the audience. I appreciate them, like, genuinely thank them. And when you're talking from stage, it depends how big the audience, like, I've spoken in arenas of 10,000 people before. So when you speak, you have to wait for your message to land.
Right.
Okay. And you'll hear Obama do this. When you see Obama speak, there's always pauses because that pause waits until land. So you got the introduction, and then you got to do the what's in it for them. So in this presentation, I'm going to show you one way to earn a passive income without having to trade time for money. I'm going to show you how to invest in an asset that increases in value. I'm going to blah, blah, blah. Right. So you show the what's in it for them. Right. Then you earn the right. Because the question they're asking in their mind is,
Why am I listening to you?
Okay, right. What's your credibility? Tell me. So when you tell the credibility, you got to tell the story of the struggle, right? And how the result that you want right now in this room, I've been through that. I'm going to tell you the struggle. And this is what happened before. So it's kind of like a before and after. That's okay. The story.
Chinese restaurant is a good way of doing
right,
it.
Right, okay. Right. And then the fourth part is the how. So when you're teaching the how, always turn it into a model. If you look at Stephen Covey's book, 7 Habits of Successful People, or highly effective people, that book's still a bestseller. Why? Because it has a model in there that when your message, when you teach it to someone, it has to be replicable.
Replicable, yeah.
Replicable, okay. Right, right, tongue
okay,
twister.
Okay.
So when you teach the model, at the end of your presentation, someone else should be able to teach someone else when they leave, because that then builds your name. So the model that you teach on how they do it, it's got to be a model. Right, and that's the mistake most speakers make. They don't modelize what they do, therefore the message doesn't spread.
Right.
Right. And the fifth part is that you need to segue, right? So this is a transition. And the transition is for the call to action. So in your TED Talk, if you're talking and you want the audience to do something, maybe you want to raise some money for charity. Maybe you want your message is this, you know, this charity here, they need money, you need to give money. Maybe your product, you're trying to offer a product or a service. Maybe you just want to get people to think differently and do something and make a change. That the fifth part is that transition. So you transition from what you're talking about to what you want them to do.
Right, okay.
And the sixth part is, hey, here's what you can do. Here are the options for you. And seven is go and do it. It's the call to action. Okay. So that's a seven play. And every time I speak, I always talk about these seven. My entire presentation is done in these 7 points. I don't use any PowerPoints. I just speak. And you speak from that. A lot of it's authenticity. A lot of speakers go on stage and they're trying to be someone else. They're trying to be, you know, big other speakers. But just be yourself.
Right, because people see through that very quickly. Like you said, you got about 10 seconds. You probably have more like 5 seconds.
Correct.
When you first go on. Tell me about your low moment. I'm guessing crashing the Lamborghini wasn't the best day.
No.
Probably because you're worried about the car more than you.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I don't know. So was that a low for you? What was the time where you were like, I think I'm going to quit? Although I don't think that's probably something you would do. But what was the lowest for you?
I remember early on in my property career, I learned this way of buying houses really quick, you know, and it was like almost a miracle. It was like, my God, I could just literally buy a house, boom. But what I didn't realize was that when you buy too many houses, that's also a problem. And I remember having, how many was it? It was about 8 houses that I'd bought that all needed to fix them, because my strategy was, I'm going to buy them, I'm going to fix them up, and then I'm going to sell them, right? But what I didn't realize, when you buy too many at once and you have to fix too many at once and you have to fund too many at once, that's a problem.
Because you're subject to the market moving?
No, because let's say you're putting £20,000 into each house.
Yeah.
Times that by 8. Then each house takes 3 months to fix up and renovate, right? So then you've got holding costs.
Okay.
Now you're paying a mortgage on that. It's like, my God. You know, and I remember sitting there thinking, what am I going to do about this?
Running out of capital.
I was running out of money. I mean, okay. My bank account is like up here. It's like, do, do, do. Every month was like this. And I'm sitting there, sleepless nights, not being able to sleep. You know, I put on so much weight. And I was like, I thought myself into fear of paralysis. I mean, I literally was paralyzed. And I remember sweeping everything under the carpet, kind of like, oh, they'll sort themselves out. Until one day I get another phone call. One of my houses has just been turned into a cannabis farm. So someone had taken one of my houses and they turned it into a cannabis farm, and the damage on that property was £30,000. And I thought, my God, my bank account was looking like this right now.
You couldn't afford this.
I just couldn't. I was like, it's just, and here's the thing. It's like when you're in desperate times, calls for desperate measures, right?
Right.
And you get very, very creative. And this is where you just got to pull yourself out of that deep hole. Because in my mind, I was like, you know what? I can just let everything go into bankruptcy. And,
right.
And then I can recover in 5 years because I can start again.
Right.
You know, I had all these thoughts going through my head. But then on the flip side, I could see all the people that told me, you know, it's too risky, you shouldn't do this, and you can't do this, and you'll never do this. And I just saw their faces, like, I still remember them now, just like pointing.
And you didn't want to give into that.
And I didn't want to give into that because, not because I would become bankrupt if I gave up, but failing this would also fail my friends and family.
You know, it's Chinese guilt.
It's a Chinese guilt thing. It was like, my God.
But it saved you.
My God, it saved me a lot of times. I'm
okay, so saving face and the name, the family name, and shame and disgrace, those are things that you know well.
Yeah.
But you can use them as tools.
Oh, my God, they are so powerful.
Okay,
bro.
But they can't. So but as powerful. Long as they don't keep you from acting, right? Because you've seen that the extreme of that is people not going outside of the box,
yeah,
and just staying on the traditional way. Talk to me about comfort zones, because I watched one of your lectures and you threw the circles and the, yeah, comfort zone, and it comfort zone gets a lot of lip service these days,
yeah,
but I don't think people think about it enough.
Mm.
And I think you said one in one of your talks that when you're not outside the comfort zone, you know, then nothing's happening. You talked about competing against yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually fascinating because there's a guy, Dorian Yates, 6-time Mr. Olympia from Birmingham, up near where you're from.
Whoa.
You know, he said he always competed with himself, and that's how he became the best. And when he won Mr. Olympia, he's like, Brian, I didn't celebrate because I was supposed to win, and I went back home and started lifting again. Mm. So that's what he did. And I find a lot of the successful people that sit in that chair do compete against themselves.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear everyone tell them they're great. They're like, that wasn't good enough.
Mm.
So talk to me about the comfort zone, because I'm the same way. If I don't feel like I've put something on the line that week or risked it, I don't feel like I was good enough that week. Mm. How do you get out of the comfort zone? comfort zone, because the reason it's called a comfort zone is because it's not nice to get out of. Right. So even the most steadfast guys and achievers fall back into it, right?
Well, you know, when I say this, a lot of the viewers are going to think I'm crazy. And,
maybe they do already, but you're driving a Lamborghini. That's okay.
You know, they're going to think, you know, that's, no, we shouldn't do that. I mean, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but this is what I do. I always put myself in situations that I can't get out of, right? In the Chinese saying that says that when you're in a boat, you need to break the boat and swim to the island. Because when you break the boat, you either drown and die or you survive. And I'm not sure if other people agree with that, but that's just something I always put myself in positions where I cannot fail. Failure is not an option.
What's an example of that?
So there's one tech project that I did. I took all the money, I put it in there, and I thought, it has to work. It has to work. If it doesn't work, then I'm going to let everyone down. Because, you know, I'd raise a lot of money for that, you know? Right. And, you know, and just so happens it's done very well, okay. You know, in my job, you know? It's funny because in my job, I'd always wanted to be one of the top animators. And on the day that I quit my job, I was actually offered a £60,000 job. £60,000. And I worked so hard to get this position. And she said to me, she said, John, you know, if you don't take this position, I have to give it to someone else. I said, right. So I had this whole conversation going in my head. Do I take this £60,000 job and get the role that I've always wanted? Or do I lose it, be ashamed in the industry because I'd let someone else down, and then do my own thing? And that was another thing when I made that conscious decision. And I always say this is like, people are not committed. They say they're committed. They're not committed. They just kind of want it, right? If you don't commit, you're telling the universe, I'm not ready. The moment you commit is the moment you start getting a lot of opportunities. I mean, that's what's happened for me in my life. When I commit full on, I, for some reason, I get luckier.
Things happen.
Yeah.
Because right? People feel that energy. That's that sixth sense, maybe. They know that you're serious.
Yeah.
Okay, so comfort zones. How do you regularly get yourself out of yours? How can people learn to get out of theirs? How can they know when they're out? And the funny thing is, once you're out, you end up going right back into the comfort zone, right? Because it becomes your new comfort zone. You've done that in one of your talks with concentric circles, right?
Yeah.
So talk to me about that.
Well, it's kind of like a ripple. You drop a pebble into a pond, you get ripples. Right. And, you know, the thing that people are fearing the most is actually an indicator of what they do need to be doing next. So if they're sitting there thinking, I should get into business, but they're too scared, that's what you need to be doing next. If you're thinking, I need to quit my job, that's what you need to be doing next. Because once you quit your job, that's it. You're letting go of security. This is the difference between...
You broke the boat.
Freedom and security. Do you want security or do you want freedom? And personally, I think if you're working in the job, that's actually more risky because someone can turn around to you like they did to me and say, you're fired. And then you have no job. You know, so how do you expand your comfort zone is you need to do things that are really uncomfortable. Like, you know, they're uncomfortable, but I'm not saying, hey, if you're scared of jumping off a cliff, you should jump off a cliff.
Because there's always
the extreme. I'm not saying that.
I used to have an expression with someone on the show, and he used to say, Brian, go to where the fear is.
Yeah.
He always said that. And then I'd be like, okay, so you want me to go stand in front of a bus? So there's a medium there.
But, yeah, I mean.
But usually your fears tell you where you should go.
It's an indicator.
Okay, again, it's an indicator. Instinct.
Like, if you want to invest in property, but you're too scared to get on the prop ladder, that's what you should be doing.
Right.
If you're too scared to have children and have a kid and then become a father or a mother, that's what you need to be doing. Right? And so all these, your body tells you things. Like, when you're not well, you know, you get a headache, you get a cough, you get a sore throat. That's your body saying, hey, you're not well. That's an indicator. And what people do, they get a few aspirins, take it. That's not what you should be doing. You should rest. So your body, again, I think there's something spiritual about your body that gives you, I believe in my life, I get a guardian angel. You know, some presence that always guides me in the right direction.
You do believe that?
I do believe that.
Interesting.
You know, there's always been times where I've been really low in my really low times. And just sometimes I just feel really lost. Like, I don't know what to do. But somehow I get out of the situation. It's like a miracle, you know? And you've got to really believe in this stuff. Like, if you believe you can do it, you're right. If you believe you can't do it, you're still right. It's all down to your self-belief. You know, there's a test that measured people who are optimistic and pessimists. Pessimists, if you put them into a test, they'll do better than optimists, right? But optimists overall do better because they have no ceiling. they're always striving for something bigger, something bigger than them, achievable than them. You know, so one of the things I believe is that how you get out of your comfort zone, you got to listen to your body. You got to listen to your gut. You got to listen to the mind and make a calculated guess. Right? If you're going to do something, do some research. You know, have your own proof, because that's what I needed actually when I quit my job. I needed, in my mind, I was like, let me see if I can do a few deals first in a job. And if I can do that, imagine how many I could do without being in the job. So people need to set the criteria of the proof on what they need, what needs to happen to them in order for them to know that they need to break out of the comfort zone.